Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller, and I'm recording on the 11th of November. And this is the audio for my Markets Now presentation, which I gave last night. It was a splendid event. We had four speakers, and I will try to get more of the presentations. We also had a sellout performance. We restrict the numbers to 35 because of the size of the room and the screens, and because we want to maintain a reasonably intimate environment overall, which is exactly what we had. And with many subscribers attending, and additional friends, and a few new acquaintances, and I was very pleased to meet them. Okay, now the presentation is posted on the 11th of November in my Comment of the Day section. You'll be able to find it and marry it up to the audio as I click through on the slides, and you can do the same while listening to the audio. I'll try to make this fairly brief because some of the material will be familiar to you, and well, I don't want to hold you up too long. Okay, first, although I spoke for an hour last night, including questions. Now, the title was Risks versus Rewards for Financial Markets Through Year-End and to Mid-2015. My second slide was, what are the main known risks for stock markets in your opinion? I don't want to worry people by starting off that way, but people in my position, or indeed many of you in investors and managers, you'll know when you feel that it's w very much worth being long, then you spend a lot of time worrying about what might actually go wrong. And I have listed some points. Next slide, third slide. The two that I think are the most important here right now, which I'll just repeat, is that the war against Islamic State is expensive and divisive. Then the second one is Putin is a weakened loose cannon, but can still lash out. On to the next slide, some specific market risks here. Again, I think the early ones are the most important, and that is that U.S. public offerings are at the highest level in over a decade, and you'll see a graph on this in a minute. And then leverage by hedge funds and traders has soared in the USA. Leverage in other performing stock markets is also increasing. I've mentioned this before, and again, I will have a chart to illustrate it. Okay, next slide is the fifth one in the sequence, and that shows the IPO filings and the latest data, at least that we have. And this is for in the right-hand column, you'll see 2014's filings, and of course the year is not yet over. But we've already had 332. It doesn't list the value, trading value of the IPOs, but it does list the number, and that's exceeded all the others on the page. And also, of course, that includes 2007, which was an important year for IPO. So this really represents new supply coming on, and well, never a problem as long as the cash to go into the market holds out. But at some point, it does become a problem. Next graph is one that you've seen before, which is the New York Stock Exchange margin debt, and also the S&P 500. This debt level does concern me. But again, if the market is maintaining its overall upward trend, and I know we had a wobble, a big wobble, that 9% correction for the S&P that we saw a short while ago. But as long as that doesn't erode confidence too much, and also as long as there's cash on the sidelines, then it can still rise. But at some stage, that leverage is going to definitely be a problem. But I don't think it's a, we know it's not a short-term problem because of the way the market bounced back last month. But it could well be from last month's lows, but it could well be a problem over the, well, it will certainly be a problem at some stage, but not right now. And just staying with that slide for another moment, you'll notice that it's adjusted for real values, and so that the gains that we've seen to date, it's not it's not exactly up to date, but close to it. And we're only just testing those 2000 highs in real terms, in real inflation-adjusted terms. The next graph, another presentation of the same thing, only it's not adjusted for inflation on the S&P. Okay, then another one that you haven't seen before in all probability, which is the Buffett indicator showing corporate equities to GDP. Not as high as it was in 2000, but it's certainly higher than it was in 2007. And the level is high generally. So there's a lot of speculative interest in the US stock markets. People often mention that the valuations, that they say, well, the valuations are reasonable. I think go cut right to the point. The valuations on average are high. They're not ridiculously high or frighteningly high. And again, as long as you have that very accommodative monetary policy, which we do, even though QE is ended, the Fed is not selling those bonds that it had bought, and so the money stays in the markets. And as you know, interest rates are very very low. Short-term interest rates are extremely low. Okay. Techno warning signs to watch for among the indices. Again, I don't mean this to be paranoid's corner here, but this is a good list just to hang on to here for things to keep an eye out for, such as the trend acceleration relative to the 200-day moving averages that occurs frequently on a short to intermediate term basis. And it does tell you that things are becoming overextended and they're more vulnerable to a mean reversion back towards the MA. And then declining market breadth, that's an issue that is number second point here that has worried me in recent months. But I think the picture is actually a little better now, dare I say, and you'll see why in a moment. Okay, and the next slide mentions some bullish points for stock markets. This first one is very important, and that is that the Standard & Poor's 500 has gained 15.3% on average 6 months after the midterm election. And that's a impressive average figure, and that goes back for at least 50 years. Then the second one, also extremely important, global monetary policy is still extremely accommodative. Okay, I'll let you read through those if you, rest of those if you wish, but I'm going to just carry on here now. And here's a graph from S&P Capital IQ, just demonstrating that point I was just mentioning about that 15.3% gain. That's where I put in the blue arrow there on this slide, and this is the 11th slide. And it also shows that the advances over decliners over that period, 94%, and the year two up above it, which is the not so good period. You can see how that has remained quite low relative to all of the others. So we're coming out of that period during the first half of the U.S. presidential election cycle, and coming into the latter half now that the midterm elections are behind us. And that's when you get a certain amount of pump priming quite often, and that's also when a fair amount of optimism is generated about possibilities in terms of a change of party control. And the stock market is obviously like the fact that the Republicans are now in charge of the Senate as well as the lower house. Okay. Next slide just shows similar data in different format, but post-midterm stock market performance for the Dow since 1950, and that you can see again after the midterm election, which we've just had, that the gains have been pretty good, more often than not. Will they be as good this year? Well, monetary policy is still very accommodative. Will stock markets be able to gain against the background of fairly high valuations? I think with some of those other gains that you see there, big gains, they occurred off a base of lower valuations more often than not. But I think again the nevertheless I think the outlook remains reasonably accommodative, and let me show you why I think so. Going on to the next slide, number 13 in the series. This is the Russell 2000, which I have repeatedly referred to as the canary in the coal mine. This lists the smaller companies. And if the market is losing, or if the market breadth is deteriorating, you'll see it first in some of the smaller cap indices, such as the Russell 2000, which had been ranging in a very toppy looking formation for really all year. And it broke down quite sharply. But lo and behold, it's pushed right back up. Feel a little better about it when it takes out that last of the lower highs, and so that we no longer have a sequence of lower highs here overall. But that's an impressive rebound, and that tells us that the stock market is out of trouble here for at least the short term, although we are overbought, as you would not be surprised to hear, on a very short-term basis. But nevertheless, overall sentiment has improved quite considerably here in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and that may well carry the market. I think it will carry the market forward during the rest of the year and beyond. Okay, long-term chart of the S&P. I just brought this up because and put another headline on there: no inflation, right up at the top. And the vertical bar, as you can see, shows that those additional gains are due to CPI inflation. So the point to remember here is that stock markets are a reasonably good hedge against inflation, provided inflation is not too strong. And I think analysts who've studied this more closely than I will point out that when inflation starts to move above 4% per annum, at least as reported, and they're talking about consumer price inflation, that then above 4%, it starts to become a headwind for the stock market. But a little bit of inflation, and even up to 4%, is still a tailwind for the stock market on average. Whereas, again, high inflation, headwind, and also deflation, additionally a headwind, as Japan saw for such a lengthy period. Excuse me, they're having hopefully a little throat-clearing cough there. And next slide. This is the S&P 500 index, which has regained that round of phobia level at the 2000 level. I call these round of phobia levels, these big round number figures, because they're widely anticipated targets as the market is approaching them. When the market reaches them, then a number of people say, well, what happens next? And that can lead to a pause and consolidation and sometimes a significant reaction. And we certainly saw a reaction. I was concerned seeing the break in the progression of higher reaction lows. You can see where I've drawn another line across the chart. So we had a bigger reaction. We also broke the sequence of higher reaction lows. And that really created two important inconsistencies there. Also broke the rising 200-day moving average. So we can call that a third inconsistency because that hadn't occurred for quite some time. But as you see, the market rallied back upwards really quite sharply. So at this stage, I think all we can say is that that shakeout is a warning overall, but obviously it did not turn out to be a serious disruption of the US bull market cycle. Next slide. Tech still very much in form. As you can see here, having bounced straight back very quickly. Here's the Nasdaq one. Next slide, Nasdaq 100 index on a more sensitive as on a daily rather than a weekly basis this time. And what's so important is that you can see that it recovered faster than it fell. And that confirmed, had to confirm, that there is a fair amount of liquidity on the sidelines. Just going to have a little drink of water. Oh, these human frailties of the voice department. But hopefully a little less scratchy. It was a lot of talking last night. And I have another audio to do later today. Okay. So, very sharp reaction, as you can see, well, relative to what had occurred previously. It was an emotional time for everyone. But it bounced back even faster. Now, that's unusual. In a weaker market environment, it's not unusual to get a sharp rally over 2 or 3 days, perhaps possibly even a week, as you get some short covering, a little bit of oversold buying. But this just kept on going up and pretty much maintained the overall momentum. And that's really, well, again, I've said it, that's impressive. It first revealing the cash on the sidelines, and also that it confirms that the belief in the buy the dips mantra is still very strong. That won't work one day, but it did work in the middle of October, as you can clearly, very clearly see. Okay, transports. This is important. I've often mentioned this point. Transports led the move to new high ground. And it's going to be railroads and airlines. And if they're doing well, then the economy is doing well additionally. That's a good measure of economic activity on a stock market index. Okay, showing three autonomies that remain reasonably in form. And in this section, I talked a little bit about be careful when you get too overextended relative to the MAs. You can expect a reaction, although that's very attractive if you've had a big overextension to the downside, as you saw in 2000 and late 2008, and particularly in first quarter of 2009, relative to the falling MA, because those moves are unsustainable. And again, this shot back up. That sharp reaction also broke the rising lows, which was a concern, but given the speed with which it's pushed back up and touched a new high, I'll still give the upside the benefit of the doubt. Although, just as a safety valve here, we would not want to see this come back below 95, and I don't think it will. And Procter and Gamble, another even more in form here, and you can see getting overextended in 2013, leading to lots of whipsaw, choppy ranging activity, mostly maintaining the higher reaction lows, and now pushing up out of this overall pattern as well. And just as long as it holds above 275, we give this the benefit of the doubt. These aren't cheap, as you see, but also they've got reasonable growth rates, selling at a 20.39 PE. That's estimated PE. Yield's not bad either, at 2.89. And the third in the sequence here is the Kimberly-Clark. And also lots of ranging up at those high levels, so we want to see this 104 level hold. That's not far away. Decent yield at nearly 3%. PE still high, but not as high as on the other two. Okay, next index is Canada. And lengthy correction due to the sharp drop in oil prices. And I think that while oil prices remain reasonably depressed, Canada's certainly likely to underperform here overall. And I regard this as a medium-term correction. Next slide, Mexico. I use this just looking at overextensions. It's a good teaching example. Seeing overextensions relative to the 200-day moving average, and when it does get quite overextended, you're much more likely to see either a sharp pullback and/or a lengthy ranging period. And as my seasoned veteran subscribers will know, that I don't use the 200-day moving average as a leading indicator, because it's anything but. It's a lagging indicator, but I do look. It's a good example of what would be a the average trend momentum, and when it gets overextended, either up or down. Then we can expect some sort of reaction, and you see that occurring repeatedly on this chart. Well worth studying, particularly if you're teaching anyone within your organization how to analyze the charts that that you can produce and that we produce from the library. Okay. UK index FTSE 100 here, and that's the 24th slide. My comments: significant breakdown from the broadening pattern, ending the sequence of higher reaction lows. That's a concern. Obviously, that 6,000 level where I've drawn another line, that's a very important level of support. I would hate to see that taken out, but that needs to be mentioned. And let's see how high this can push here. But it's along with the European markets, this has been somewhat out of favor. It is a little bit over influenced, but well, it's heavily influenced by some of the global mining shares that are also listed in London, when you get Arty's, or Rio Tinto, RTZ, and you also get BHP Billiton, and a number of others that has been a drag on the oils, on the index, as have the oil shares. Looking at the Euro Stoxx 50 index, and best that can be said about it is that having broken down below that 3,000 level, it didn't maintain it. But it's stalled in here now, right beneath that 200-day moving average, which has tipped down. Mario Draghi, after a bit of a battle, from what I gather, with the German government, has succeeded in, or German finance ministers, I should say, has succeeded in delivering the early stages of his quantitative easing program, QE. And Europe certainly needs the QE to revive the stock market. Also, the Euro banks looking weak, and the ECB had bought a very substantial proportion of the bad debts there. So this is not overall a healthy looking pattern, and we know that the European situation is facing deflationary pressures. It's facing the costs from the sanctions against Russia, and then the reprisal sanctions, as or the tit for tat sanctions, as I've described them. And I'm very cautious about Europe, except for some of the autonomies, and we'll have an example shortly. German DAX index, the most important one within the EU, broke down sharply below that 9,000 level. It was really 8,900, lower side of that ranging top formation. It has pushed back up partially into it. It needs to extend this rally if this is going to prove to be a significant downside failure. That is not yet proven, so it needs bears close watching. And said I'd mention the a European autonomy, BMW, very cheap, as you can see. Estimated PE 9.25, yield over 3%. The chart pattern, though, is a bit erratic, to put it mildly. And at minimum, it needs to get back above, well, back above that 200-day MA. But I think this is interesting because of the valuations. It's really selling, in terms of estimated PE, is selling at half the price of the three American autonomies that I showed you. And so it's paying a penalty for being a German company. But again, the definition of the autonomies, these have outgrown their countries of origin. And BMW is a big player all over the world. And the important point is, increasingly, it's building most of its factories all over the world. And so that gives it, or puts it in a much stronger position, for instance, than the German economy generally, or the EU economies overall. And I should also mention that Daimler has a very, also in the same industry, of course, has similar pattern, and even a slightly higher yield. Okay, Russia. Well, I don't need to say a whole lot about this. You know my view, but governance is everything, and you've got a dangerous loose cannon here in Putin. If Putin were replaced, this would instantly become a very attractive recovery candidate overall. And you may say, or well, anyone might may say, yes, but really they only produce resources and military equipment. Well, that's partly the government, the governance issue rather. And I've been going to a lot of concerts and hearing some of my favorite Russian composers. And culturally, Russia is a wonderful place, and that's been the case for well over a century. And I just mention that just because good governance, Russia would be transformed as an economy, and that would be reflected by its stock market performance. But sadly, we have to wait for that. Here's my favorite market. Next slide, and which is India, of course. And I've talked enough about the Narendra Modi phenomenon, but I think he's the most important elected figure in well over a year. And again, economically, very, very, very savvy. We knew that from his performance in Gujarat. We also learned more about his savvy campaigning and winning an overall majority, which nobody thought that he would actually be able to do. Comes from humble backgrounds, a humble background. His father's business was just selling tea, and he's a very it's a charismatic figure as well, and he's been moving around the globe quite a bit in building alliances, and this is starting to pay off in a very big way. You still see those higher reaction lows. I have described this situation a few months ago as just a wall of money coming in because everybody had run down their investment positions in India. Certainly the big institutions had. So it's been one-way traffic. And you'll know that it's no longer one-way traffic when it eventually breaks the sequence of higher reaction lows. And that will suggest that a medium-term reaction consolidation is likely to occur. But I think this is probably going to outperform the majority, may outperform all stock markets over a 5-year period here. So I remain a huge bull of India as long as Narendra Modi is prime minister. Okay. Vietnam, interesting frontier market, but there is the China problem, as you know. And the only time China and Vietnam were temporarily allies was during the Vietnam War. Next slide. China itself, I described it as enigmatic. There isn't another market where you'll have such extreme views expressed. People either love it or hate it, and in the West, more of them tend to hate it or be afraid of it, I should put it that way. Very cheap, one of the cheapest stock markets in the world. An important point is it's coming into form. I don't like much of the politics, but that's not the whole story. As you will know and also see in a minute. At first, we look at the Hong Kong index, which has been edging back up at that sharp reaction that you see commencing in October. That's really because of that long dispute, mostly students, but protesting. Bringing part of Hong Kong's, well, center of Hong Kong's business community to a standstill. They don't want their freedoms eroded by China. It's as simple as that. And is this the acceptable face of China? Here's the reincarnation of Alibaba, which had been floated back in 2007. And you'll see a chart of that in a minute. But doing spectacularly well since and it's since its float in the USA. And I delayed recording this audio because I wanted to catch a program today, and CNBC was interviewing Jack Ma, who is the founder. And you probably know a bit about him, but he was an English teacher, which is interesting, Chinese English teacher. And he founded Alibaba 15 years ago in his flat. And it's now on a stock market capitalization that is greater than that of Walmart. Well, is this justified or is this just a fair amount of hype? Well, I watched this lengthy interview with CNBC. He's a remarkable figure, very modest. The teacher aspect comes through when he talks about not only his employees but also businesses, developing businesses within China. He's very sincere. He just very impressive. I'll see if I can get some of those tapes and post them on the site. And you know my view, governance is everything, and I think that I would certainly give Alibaba the benefit of the doubt based on what I've seen in terms of Jack Ma's achievements to date. Next chart. I said that it was the reincarnation. That next one you can see when it was floated in 2007. That was on Hong Kong, and you can also see where I've drawn in the green arrow where it was acquired by the Alibaba's listed in the U.S. Moving on, other markets that I like, and they're mainly in the Asia Pacific region, as you will probably already know. To me, Japan is an absolutely classic recovery candidate following governance changes. I mean, I know there's been a lot of hand-wringing about what is called Abenomics, what Shinzo Abe has introduced in terms of the programs. But what would you do? You've spent over a generation, you've seen Japan and over a generation suffering from deflation, and you're going to let that continue indefinitely? Well, fortunately not. And I think this, again, I've said it, makes this a classic recovery candidate. World's third largest economy. Should maintain that position, and it's a high-tech economy as well. Okay, looking at Australia. Again, it's a market that I like. It tends to do well in the latter section of a global bull market cycle. Are we in the latter section? Well, we're well into a bull market cycle, that's for sure. But one of the reasons why Australia does well is because the highly cyclical resources sector tends to take off in the latter section. And indeed, many of the mining shares tend to do best after the headline indices have actually peaked around the globe. You get this strong, really strong late run. In the commodity resources. That hasn't started yet here, but it's tomorrow's potential. I also like New Zealand here as well, as you can see on the next slide, and that's number 38. Okay, very long-term bull factors for stock markets. And there's a little bit of overlap with some of the with the earlier bullet points that I put up, but accommodative monetary policies until growth accelerates. When will growth accelerate? You've got lots of different views on that. It will be led among the Western economies. It'll be led by the U.S., in my opinion. I don't think it's about to happen. These recoveries from serious credit crises, recessions, and this is certainly the most serious since the 30s, takes a long time, as I've said on many occasions. Therefore, we still have accommodative monetary policy, and there is no more bullish fundamental factor for stock markets. And what you've also heard me mention before is an accelerating rate of technological innovation. This is hugely important, and it is it we all benefit from that, except for the people who find their jobs being replaced by technology before they can get a new job. I would say that while everyone generally benefits from technological innovation, the corporations benefit most of all. Third big plank, lower energy prices in real terms, thanks to innovation and also, well, that means technology as well. And that is probably, well, that's actually occurred sooner than I was forecasting. I thought it would be clearly evident before the end of this decade, and here in 2014, in the end of the third quarter, we're seeing evidence of it. More on that in a moment. Moving on. And you can see the chart now of these US 10-year government bond yields. I've used a long-term 50-year chart on this, just so you can see that whole back history. And the graph speaks for itself. I think this is a gradual base-building process overall. But levels to watch out for is initially are above 3%, and that would provide clear additional evidence of the base formation overall, and above 4%, then we need to start to see how strong is the U.S. economy growing, and is this starting to become a headwind generally for stock markets. At current, at present, it is certainly not a headwind for the U.S. stock market. Here's the total return. Next slide. And this is number 41 in the sequence. This Merrill Lynch chart of the 10-year Treasury total return. And it's been a phenomenal bull market. And when it breaks that red line in there that I've drawn, I think that will be confirming evidence that the bull market is over, and that will be a very different environment. And a lot of things will have to be reassessed at that point. But it's not going to happen overnight. And the US dollar. Everybody's talking about how strong the US dollar is, and it's had a good rally in here recently. As again, I'm putting this on another 50-year chart overall, but you could see that the dollar really is extremely low still, despite the excellent rally that we've seen in the last couple of months. And I think that there's a reasonable chance that the dollar will be moving above that 90 level. Previously, the Fed had intervened at this level. That was the Bernanke Fed back at that time. Will they do it again? Will they intervene up here at the 90 level? We'd have to be a fly on the wall to be sure, but I doubt they will. I doubt they will, but I think it's quite certain that the Fed will listen carefully to what corporate exporters are saying, and that they will intervene at some stage. But as for now, the dollar is still an appreciating currency, a little overbought in the short term. But everybody talks about this being such a hard currency. Well, look at the next slide. There's the purchasing power. And that tells the whole sorry tale here. Basically, the dollar is a fiat currency. And the Fed wants a rate of inflation that is at least 2% per annum, preferably a little bit above that level. And sometimes inflation gets out of control, as we've seen in the past, where you see, look at back in the late 70s, early 80s, and you see that coming down at an even steeper rate on this semi-logarithmic scale chart. So just think what everything costs that you would buy when you were a kid, and it'll tell you all you need to know about the loss of purchasing power that not only the U.S. dollar, but every other currency experiences, and some lose it more quickly than sometimes considerably more quickly than the U.S. dollar has. But we live in a fiat currency world, which takes us on to the next chart, number 44, in this sequence. And we're not that far from the end, you'd be probably relieved to hear. And it's gold. And the upper left side headline says it's gold is hard money, although everybody's forgotten about that right now. Nobody's talking about gold as hard money, but it's been hard money for centuries, albeit with a fluctuating price. I mean, there isn't anything that you and I or anyone else can buy or sell that doesn't fluctuate in price, sometimes really quite dramatically. But the long-term history of gold is that it holds its purchasing power. It became had a huge move to the upside, became overextended. We've been in what I think is a cyclical bear market, and that broke support, as you know, and you can see the points that I make to the right hand side. It's been a bit of a plaything for the investment bankers, and they've been talking it down. Lots of bearish forecasts, they've been selling it short, occasionally covering a little bit and then hitting it again heavily on the short side, and they're working in concert. But it isn't just the investment banks that are interested in gold, and for very different reasons. We have buying. The main buying is coming from the Indians and particularly the Chinese right now. China, incidentally, is the biggest producer of gold right now in the world, and it doesn't export it. It wants to keep it in China, and China also encourages its citizens to accumulate gold. One of the reasons for that is it wants to have the reserves. It wants to become a reserve currency. But let's go back to that third point there. Has it not yet reached sufficient revulsion stage? You know, that's when people say, I never want to hold gold again. I haven't heard that this time around, although somebody may have said it along the way. What is interesting is that the downside forecasts are increasing, and that's usually a giveaway signal that we know that Goldman Sachs and the other investment banks are widely talking of $1,000. That was the low downside forecast, but more recently we've had some smaller investment banks coming out and saying $800. Just as at the high side, people always exaggerate, they extend the big forecasts. Okay, next slide. And you can see here on a daily chart of gold that last Friday had that big upside key day reversal. It did not get any follow through to the upside yesterday. Actually, it fell fairly sharply, but as I speak right now, gold is trading at $1,162, so it's up nearly $11 right now. Has been a little higher on the day, and if it takes out that 1180 level, that will suggest that this oversold rally is continuing. This is also the underside of the range, so it's taking place at an important level here so far. Overall, I don't want to talk about gold for too long. I think it's interesting. It's fallen enough to be at a very interesting level. Value buyers, Indians and Chinese, are actually buying it. My biggest concern is the fact that maybe we haven't seen enough revulsion. And if you look at the next slide, which is the dark that dark one that I picked up that graph from Bloomberg, that is the Dow gold ratio and shows the Dow moving up against gold. And you know, if we think for the last several years, you've had not only the bond market bull trend, but the stock markets have been doing really very well since their 2008 to 2009 lows. And so, with stock markets doing well, and with the bond market still providing real returns, although only just, you know, a lot of people say, well, why do I need gold? And at least in the West, that's what a lot of people are saying, and they're saying it doesn't yield anything here, and people are concerned about yield, whereas shares do provide some decent yields. So all the more reason not to buy. But the people who come from the older civilizations, they have a knack for buying gold when it is starting to becoming somewhat cheaper. I remember Julian Baring. You'd have to be a veteran subscriber to remember the name of Julian Baring. Quite a character. But he used to talk about, you know, he based gold on the cost of a good suit, which no doubt he would have bought on Savile Row. And you know, there are plenty of suits that are being sold on Savile Row and elsewhere by some of the more fashionable designers that cost a good deal more than the $1,162 that gold is trading at right now. And of course, there are a number of suits that sell for considerably less. Next slide. Silver, high beta gold, will outperform when the yellow metal really has bottomed back at an interesting level, dropping down to that 15 nearly. That's quite a move from the highs, and again, looking interesting. I think anybody who comes into this market, you don't want to be leveraging up heavily because you're still in overall downtrends. That would be risky and unnerving. But people who are coming in and just gradually accumulating on weakness, you know, a decade from now, I would guess you'd be very, very happy with those positions and almost inevitably sooner. Definitely sooner. Okay, Brent crude oil. And here we go. There's the daily chart. Oversold, as you can see, but what kind of rallies are we going to get here? I've just As it says, I think it would be unlikely to hold rallies above the 105 level. I'll go on to the next slide, which is my last one here. And or the last one that I used last night. But I think this is, as I say, on this 50 this I beg your pardon, this 49th slide, the end of an era for producers of crude oil, and they are definitely losing price control. And I think you know the reasons why. Again, we can thank technology, which enables sophisticated oil firms to go back into and redrill in areas that were felt to be depleted. And with the horizontal drilling and other technologies that they can use to pinpoint pockets of oil, so they're constantly finding that they can go back and find more oil in some of their favorite wells of many years ago. But the bigger issue is the fracking, and that is a growing business, fortunately. So I think we have a global interest in needing to see lower energy prices, and that will continue. But then there's new nuclear, and there's the renewables, there's increasing competition, and we're not going to run out of crude oil, but crude oil will be eventually become much less important than it is today. So I think that's good news here overall, and it's a good point to end this presentation. So again, all the very best to all of you.